your mangy dogs. Swab the decks and hoist the sails. The guns on board be needin' some proper madam. Pieces of eight and a fine wench on your arm. If your work be not too shoddy. Careful not to flounder too badly, though, or you may have to dance the hempen jig as we see you to Davy Jones. But Jeffy, my boy, on with the show.
Ahoy, me hearties. To our listeners from across all regions of the planet, welcome once again aboard the Robin Hood, flagship to the world's one and only cooperatively inspired charity podcast network. Broadcasting today from under sporadically sprayed South Korean skies, this is episode 42 of Pirate Radio Podcasts. I'm your host and Chief Communications Officer, Jaffe Ryder. Tonight's guest, Michigan-based researcher and author Robert Homrich. Over the course of the next 90 minutes or so, we'll be exploring the secret and mysterious world of America's political capital, Washington, D.C. If time allows, a few other topics we hope to touch on will likely range anywhere from the so-called straw man legal fiction, naval admiralty law, Freemasonry, and the arcane roots of Christmas.
Oh, well, Pirate Larry, can you believe it? Another week has just flown by, and here we are again. I see you're up in the crow's nest there with your spyglass.
Yeah, it's a little cold up here, Jaffe. I'm trying to string some lights for Christmas for the Secret Santa parade that we're going to have out here in the Pirate Bay.
That's great. That's the spirit. So I guess you got the memo from the captain as well, too. So,
John Sinclair, yes. Captain Sinclair sent the memo, and I'm on board and working at it. Sir.
Everyone in the ship seems to be getting into the spirit. Now, we had our guest last week, of course. He was another Robert. He was having some technical problems, wasn't able to make it onto the show because of, I guess, his Wi-Fi and Skype connection. But this week's guest, another, we're going to call him Rob, I guess, for the course of the show here today. But he was having some issues, but he's with us now, apparently. Do you see him anywhere there with your out on the docks here? You got to manage to get a bead on him with your spyglass?
Hi, Jeffy. He's out on the docks. He's waiting to board. But we should probably ask him a pirate question.
Yeah, he's got a... If we can... I don't see him anywhere. Rob, are you anywhere around? I'm kind of looking around here. I can't... You there, Rob?
I'm here.
Ah, Mr. Homrich. Literally the wealthy man. Good to have you join us today.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, yeah, like, Larry, why don't you give him the rundown there just to... It's an overview, kind of how the deal works here on the Robin Hood, what it takes to really, you know, formally gain to be able to board the ship.
Yeah, you're out on the docks right now. So in order to board the ship, we need a pirate story or a pirate jig or a pirate joke, something like that, and then you'll get permission to board.
I think I can accommodate you on that. Well, I got the story. Pirate walks into a bar, right? And the bartender looks at him. He's like, geez, man, what happened to you? You look horrible. And, you know, the pirate looks at him. He's like, arr, what do you mean? I feel fine. He's like, well, last time I saw you, you didn't have that wooden leg. What's up with that? He's like, arr, well, I'd be in battle the other day, and Cannonball took my leg off, but it's all right. I got this great doctor. He fixed me up. I'm fine, really. He's like, oh, I see. Well, last time you were here, you didn't have that hook either. What's up with the hook? He's like, arr, well, I caught up in another battle, and I boarded the enemy vessel and got in, caught up in a sword fight, and he lobbed my hand off. But again, I've got this great doctor, and he hooked me up with this hook, and I feel great. So I don't get it. So the bartender's like, oh, well, last time you were here, you didn't have that eye patch. What's up with that? He's like, arr, well, I was on deck, and I looked up in the sky, and a seagull pooped right in my eye. It's like, oh, that's horrible, but really, that couldn't have cost you your eye. What happened? He's like, well, I wasn't really used to me hooked yet.
I think that's the second time we've heard that joke, isn't it, Larry?
Yeah, but welcome aboard. Welcome aboard.
Well done.
I think but, hey, if it worked for the other guy.
It's one of the captain's favorites, actually. So, yeah, it's good job. Let's make our way on board the Robin Hood. So, well, it seems you've kind of been making the rounds here a little bit over the last little while with all kinds of various podcast appearances. You've got a book that's been published as well, and you're in the process of putting together a tour venture of sorts, I guess, so through the Washington, D.C. area. Why don't you just give our listeners, people that maybe aren't familiar with your history and background, personal story, just a quick overview of who Robert Homrich is and what brings him to the show today.
Well, pirate jokes I can accommodate, but a quick overview of who I am, that's a tougher one. I guess the answer you're really looking for, I'm probably best known for my research on Washington, D.C., and it goes pretty deep. Obviously, that's the subject of my book. As you mentioned, I'm planning on starting a tour in Washington, D.C. to kind of guide the public through some of my research. So that's pretty much what I'm best known for. I do a lot of other stuff, though. So, again, it's really hard to pin down just who I am in just a few sentences, but I think that's the answer you're looking for.
Yeah, that's well, and we've got you, that's right, here. We're hoping to get into the esoteric levels of what Washington is all about, its history and the architectural engineering layout, so the design and whatnot. Very much kind of a Da Vinci Code sort of discussion here, hopefully, today.
Sure, actually. Mm-hmm. Sorry, go ahead.
No. You're wild.
Well, I was just going to comment that Dan Brown's a great place for us to start, really, because my work is actually completely unrelated to his, but yet it bears an astonishing number of startling similarities. I guess let's just start with one of the reasons that the Catholic Church got into such a fuss over his book was the fact that he mixed fact and fiction. I'm sorry, I'm getting a really bad echo right now. Do you hear that?
Well, a little bit. You know, I'm not sure if it's from my end or not. What I'll do, though, just in an effort to kind of troubleshoot things here, is I'll put on some headphones. You continue and go ahead, and we'll see how things turn out there.
Well, one of the controversies of his books, though, really stems from his story of the Knights Templar. And one of the things that he goes into, I mean, he speculates in the book the reasons why the Knights Templar were stationed on the Temple Mount. And, of course, he ties it all in with this theory that they were actually searching for a lost artifact that had gone missing since the time of Christ. And so this caused a lot of controversy just in itself, aside from the other stuff. But when you really start to look at things logically, I mean, he didn't just make this up on his own. This is a real kind of legend that exists out there that he kind of adopted and incorporated into his book. But when you really start to examine what the Templars were doing on the Temple Mount, to me, it makes more sense that he speculates that they were seeking the Holy Grail of Christ, basically, that's what he speculates they were searching for. But when you look at it from a more logical perspective, it makes more sense that they were actually seeking the Ark of the Covenant, because that is the location where, you know, recorded history lost track of that artifact. So it seems to me if they were searching for anything on the Temple Mount, that would be what they were looking for.
Now, Rob, I've heard you make this point in earlier interviews. Let's see if we could just get a little clearer on this exactly. So can you just sort of flesh that out a little bit and give us more of the particulars, how it was that the Ark was said to have disappeared at that particular time? Is it and in Jerusalem?
Well, sure,
Jerusalem.
Right. The Temple Mount, of course, is stationed was in Jerusalem. Basically, that was the location, or is believed to be the location of Solomon's Temple from the Bible, the biblical tales, and all that. And anybody who studies their Bible will know that the temple was destroyed. I believe it was about 500 years prior, but of course the ruins remain there. And of course now in modern times, the Dome of the Rock is actually positioned directly over where the Holy of Holies of Solomon's Temple was. So there's that controversy there as well. I mean, the Christians, you know, they claim that as one of the most holy sites in the world. And of course, the Muslims are doing that as well. So there's an eternal struggle just for that kind of that little piece of land. And of course, during the Crusades, that's where the Templars were stationed. And of course, you know, that so. I don't know if you need me to be more clear on what that's about, but essentially,
I know Graham Hancock is a well-known author that's gone into some detail there. I believe, in fact, he's written a book on the whole whole affair. Is it not speculated that it somehow made its way secretly from Jerusalem to Ethiopia?
Yes, that is one that is certainly one of the legends as it goes. I believe Graham Hancock was one of the forerunners of promoting that idea. Now, I could only speculate myself what really happened to it, and I do have my own ideas about that, and it's all incorporated in my work. We'll kind of get there eventually, but that's kind of, I'm kind of using this all as a setup to where we're going to kind of end our whole little treasure hunt mystery. You know, you're pirates, you like to hunt for treasure. Well, that's kind of what we're going to do tonight. But I kind of wanted to use this all as kind of a setup to kind of lead us into my own research, which, again, you touch upon Dan Brown, his book, The Lost Symbols, all centered around Washington, D.C., and that's what my work's all centered around. And there's a lot of similarities in that as well. Anyway, I just wanted to make a point that, you know, it all really stems from the Templars. And we were discussing earlier about any possible connections between pirates and the Freemasons. And I didn't have a lot of time to do as much research as I'd like, but one of the things I uncovered was, the Knights were persecuted in 1307. By the Pope and the King of France. You know, that's a legend that's in Dan Brown's books too, but it's all based on fact. So it was around 1307 that the Templars were basically exterminated.
Or sent into hiding, driven underground.
Right, and that's really what happened. Of course, they did round up as many as they could, but they couldn't round them all up as calculated and coordinated as their efforts were. There were some that slipped through the cracks, and of course, the first thing they did was they went to the shipyards, the dockyards, got in their boats, and hightailed it out of there. Now, at that time, you know, they had such a widespread presence in Europe and in the Middle East and all that. They had lots of assets. They had boats. They had all of that, and they shipped out to sea, the ones that escaped. And they were kind of never heard of. Well, it's interesting that it was right around that time that pirates started becoming a problem. So one could easily equate a connection between the Templars disappearing and these pirates turning up at sea. Of course, it's speculation, but, you know, it's reasonable speculation. And it's interesting time frame that, you know, the Templars disappear and all of a sudden pirates emerge. And that's one of the things I go into in my book as well, is I kind of hint to the concept that the Templars never really went anywhere. They went underground and they just reemerged with a new name. Okay, so it's illegal to be a Templar. Okay, well, is it illegal to be a Freemason? Because I'm not a Templar anymore. Now I'm a free. It's all wordplay. And when you get into legalities, that's what legalities really are in the end. So, you know, I kind of hint to people that maybe there's a possibility that the Templars simply just evolved into this new version known as the Freemasons. And one of the things that really got the Pope and the King of France in an uproar to the point where they wanted to persecute the Templars was because they began expressing an interest in founding their own monastic state, much like the Knights Hospital were doing in Prussia, and I believe it was Prussia, and there was another sect that was doing something in Rhodes. I'm trying to think, it's escaping me right now. But basically, there were all these different sects that had built up a lot of power from the Crusades that all wanted to start their own countries. And of course, the nobility didn't like that idea at all, and so they had to put a stop to it. And that's one of the reasons they did. It was because the Knights Templar were just getting too powerful. And when you have the power to, like, start founding countries and stuff, that just can create more problems for the nobilities who already have their control of power. So there's a lot of reason there to speculate where I do in my book and say that the Templars never really went anywhere. They went underground and reemerged as the Freemasons, and in fact, they did manage to found their own nation. And, probably a good portion of your listeners are living in that nation right now. So,
what nation would that be exactly?
Oh, that would be the United States.
All right, let's just hold it there for a second, because one of the questions that we've got for you here is regarding the missing Templar fleet. And you've kind of skirted on the edge of things there, but is there any way you could go into maybe what happened? Because as you said, the Templar fleet and they, according to the lore, is that they loaded a lot of the
There's a couple things I left out about the legend. One, like in Dan Brown's book, in the film, he makes it a big point that they were there and they were searching, and then one day they just stopped searching and they went back to the homelands, and that's when their rise to great power and fame and wealth and all that, that's where that really began. And of course, Dan Brown speculates in his book that it was because they found something on the Temple Mount that gave them leverage over the Catholic Church. And of course, that also contributed to their desire to persecute him and eradicate him from the face of the earth, is because they actually knew something. Now, what they found, you could speculate. Maybe they found the Ark of the Covenant, maybe they found the Holy Grail, or maybe they even just found knowledge. Or then again, maybe they found all of the above. And furthermore, maybe what if all of the above were all one and the same? So that's kind of where my book kind of leads us.
Okay, just to let listeners know, we have a few people here on YouTube. Greyland is one of the, and Tyranny Unmasked, two that we can see here, two of the regular crew members that have managed to make themselves known. So a big shout out to those two colorful characters. Greyland seems to be very much digging the discussion here. I'm not sure. Hopefully, maybe even have a question or two to offer you, but just sure. To let listeners know that we have I know on this end we have some audio issues with your signal. I guess you're in a somewhat semi-remote location at the moment, is that right?
Me? Well, right now I'm showing I do have a decent signal. I'm staying put where I'm at. It's somewhere in northwestern Ohio, just between the border and heading back to our home in Piqua. I just had to stop where I was sure I had a signal, wouldn't lose it. I think we're good.
Yeah, it's workable. We can definitely, we're gonna work with what we got here. So, right. But it's just, it would just to let people know that you're calling, I guess, on your cell phone. You're on speaker phone at the moment from your vehicle, I guess. So
yeah, that's correct.
All right. Now, I'm not sure if Pirate Larry has any questions for Robert at the moment or not, but I'm sure that he's been listening attentively and might have a thing or two that he'll want to perhaps throw out at our guest, Pirate Larry.
Well, it's very interesting, this idea that, the Knight Templars went off and became powerful and disappeared. and maybe started another religion. I believe that the Masonic religion was banned for a long time also, wasn't it, in Europe?
Right. Well,
it became like a
technically the Masons, they don't subscribe, technically, if you ask them anyway, the official story is that they don't subscribe to any particular religion. The prerequisite is a belief in a higher power or a god, a creator, but they're not specific about that. You can believe in any, you can believe in God, Allah. Some can even see Satan as their Lord, and that's just fine with them. So, you know, you people who argue there's no Satan worship in Masonry, that's not true at all. They'll take anybody who believes in a higher deity. So the only ones who are really ineligible are the atheists. So and even I kind of, you know, have to raise the question, if they do practice any particular religion, then why are they accepting of all these different religions? I think it's more than just a religion that what they do. But again, that's my own personal opinions. I don't really want to get into my own opinions any more than necessary on this. I prefer to, you know, look more closely at the facts and what we do know about Masonry. And to my knowledge, there's no particular preferred religion in the fraternity.
I think one of the points that Larry was trying to make there, though, had more to do with the persecution of the Masons throughout the history. I know, I'm pretty sure that Hitler, for example, he had them in their sights, his sights, although he did have some respect for them as well, too, apparently, because of their ability to organize and the hierarchical. He was very much into the hierarchy and, you know, the
and he had a
authority.
Great interest in the occult. We all know. So mm-hmm. Yeah.
Until Himmler was let loose and that made the doomed flight to England, I guess, and then suddenly he apparently didn't want so much to openly profess or advocate anything to do with the occult. He was publicly, at least, I guess, was quite against anything to do with those sort of esoteric matters. So, but yeah, do you know anything more then about the persecution of the Masons then?
Let's be clear, it was the Templars, not the Masons. I mean, whether they're the same or not, just to keep our bearings straight, it was actually the Templars who were persecuted.
Right.
Again, there's really not any official, I mean, the real reason they were persecuted has more to do with the fact that was it King Richard, I believe, was in debt to the Masons for his war with the French, or not the French, his war with England.
Debt to the Templars, you mean?
Right, to the Templars. Yes, I'm sorry. Now even I'm confused with the two.
Well, let me just jump in here for a second. You're making a good point. This is great. This this period and time in history, of course, very rich with the, you know, you, I mean, you, then you could spend a lot of time researching the area with all kinds of books that have been put out throughout the years. But apparently, I think Masons, I think it's around the 17th degree. I'm not sure. They got the blue and the red lodges and the Scottish Rite. And then I'm not sure what the other one is. I'm not an authority by any means. But I think it's about the 17th or 18th, maybe 19th degree that you are actually technically deemed a Knights Templar.
Yeah, I do believe there is a degree that's mostly dedicated. I can't say for certain though. You kind of got me on that one.
Okay,
but you definitely can't deny that they definitely share the same principles, the same philosophies. You know, the same traditions are carried out in the Masons that the Templars did. So I think that's an obvious sign to their connection, or even lineage, if you will, to the Templars. In fact, there are some that even claim lineage, I mean, direct lineage to that. They claim direct lineage to the builders of the pyramid, Solomon's Temple, which is even used in their ritual, but we know that that's more as a allegory to explain the principles of Freemasonry and not actually like a historical account of the real construction of Solomon's Temple. So they do claim lineage to all of these things, and personally, I wouldn't be at all surprised to find that all these things to be true. But again, one could really only speculate on these things. But I think the telltale signs are right there in their traditions, their philosophies, their ceremony. So
I've long been puzzled why it is that Masons, not officially, you know, it's like any other, they deny till they're blue in the face, really, that the official party line is that we are not a religion. But yet they, and as you said, you pointed out earlier, they'll take pretty much anyone on board, technically, who professes a belief in some higher power or supreme deity.
Well, on that note, I think anybody who works in the United States legal system would swear up and down that that's not a religion either. But when you actually take a good hard look at what our legal system is, that itself is a religion, and you really can't deny it. It's they have their high priests, they have their temples, they have their ceremonies, they have their men in their robes, it's they have their rules, their structure, their hierarchy. It's a religion, just like anything else, and it relies on the same thing any other religion is, and that is a belief in a higher power or authority.
Right. Jordan Maxwell, I think, is one of the better known figures who's done a lot of work and research and, discussion in respect to that particular issue. Here's another thing too. They gather in, they're called lodges, but really they're apparently temples. they're temples, and they have worshipful masters. I mean, you're worshiping
yes,
who?
Exactly.
Worshipful masters,
again,
rites and rituals. I mean, come on.
They hide the telltale signs right in plain sight, you know.
And then deny.
Perhaps maybe.
Like, let's just be honest about it. Like, you lose credibility, I think, in respect when it's like, come on, get real.
Sure.
So, sure, and by the way, just for the record, you yourself, we did a little pre-interview just yesterday, I guess, you've been approached by Masons from time to time, but have yet to, you're not a brother at this point, I guess, or a member of the fraternity, is that correct?
Well, at this point or at any point will I ever be, that's a lifelong decision I made. That's another one that kind of destroys their credibility. They say they don't recruit members, but, you know, I'd be lying if I said I haven't been approached by more than a few Masons saying you should come down to the lodge, you know, come down and check it out, meet some of the guys, and, you know, we'll take it from there. I mean, that's right along with what you're saying about, you know, destroying their own credibility. They say they don't recruit, but I, for one, can vouch that they have attempted to recruit me. So,
yeah, well, I think what part of it there is it all kind of hinges on this business of one's own free will, and that's very critical,
sure,
especially from a spiritual or esoteric standpoint.
Right. It's the most fundamental of all principles, mm-hmm, there can be, free will. That's
right.
the most fundamental. So
free and accepted. Free and accepted.
Sure.
So
free and accepted.
I just actually, we just shared a link with you there in the Skype chat area regarding it's off of Wikipedia, the Knights Templar Freemasonry. So people can look that over at their leisure, just over the course of whatever, if they should find the topic interesting in any way. So some people have referred to you apparently as the real life Robert Langdon, was what you were telling us. And for people who don't know, Robert Langdon, of course, was the main character in Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code. I guess he made a reappearance in The Lost Symbol too, presumably.
He's the main character of all Dan Brown's books,
right.
Inferno, all of them, yeah.
Angels and Demons.
He's the master cryptographer who, solves the secrets of the bloodline of Christ and the secrets of the layout of Washington, D.C., all that fun stuff. And, I have a couple similar things in common with him.
Okay.
Of course, he's a fictitious character and I'm not, but we still bear a lot of things in common.
Right.
So maybe we should start moving in on some of the stuff I've discovered about DC, so your listeners can learn.
Yeah, exactly. Now let's kick things off then, and what we really want to know, and the most obvious place to start with this, the kind of sinking our teeth into things a little further, is really to ask you what first got you started, and how your interest was piqued, how basically you embarked upon this journey.
Well, it actually started way before I knew it started, and before I was aware that it's or ready for it to start. I suffer from asthma. I was diagnosed at the age of 5, and I've dealt with it my entire life. And it's gotten really bad at points. And in 2000, I had an asthma attack that I didn't quite make it through. I lost all my vital signs. So I was technically clinically dead, and I had a very unusual out-of-body experience during that time. It's really hard to describe in words what I really truly experienced, but the best that I could go into lots of different details, but we could talk here all night about it, but just try to imagine what it would be like to be bombarded with every single thought ever conceived in a single instant. And you'll kind of understand what I experienced there. It was incredibly overwhelming. Basically, obviously, I didn't die. I did die, but they restored my vitals, and I spent the next 6 days in a medically induced coma. And then I woke up in the hospital. For me, it was instantaneous. It was just, I was there, and then I was back. There was no real time or even a concept of time. But then when I was back, I felt like a train wreck. I had atrophy in my legs. I couldn't eat food. I couldn't walk. It took me a while to recover from that one. But I also had this lingering memory that I just experienced something really intense, really incredible. But it was a lot like having a very intense dream and then waking up knowing you just had this very intense dream, but you can't remember the details of what the dream was about. That's what I woke up feeling like. And so I went on a journey of, just trying to find answers to that, and I joined the church for a while and did that and explored that route, and it really didn't lead me anywhere. I really didn't get anywhere for about 12 years. And then one day I sat down on YouTube, because I love architecture. I'm looking at films about architecture, and as particularly DC architecture, and I stumbled across Scott Onstott's film, Secrets in Plain Sight. And in the first segment of that film, he goes into detail about the design of Washington, D.C., with all the sacred geometry, the astrological alignments, and all these different connections. And as I'm watching this video, it suddenly occurred to me that there were some very key elements missing from the puzzle. He was missing some very key components. And what's more is I knew exactly what they were and how they fit together to tell a cohesive story. It just occurred to me that I knew it. And so I was doubtful. And obviously I didn't even think back to the near-death experience I had 12 years prior. It didn't even occur to me, but I just started playing around with this concept in my head and creating these scaled diagrams and started, piecing this together, only to confirm what I already knew, that I did, in fact, have these key components to a puzzle that, the world just obviously wasn't aware of. And of course, when I had this near-death experience, one of my first thoughts is, they just had me on some really powerful drugs. I could have just hallucinated the whole thing, for all I know. But it lingered in there. There was something more than that. And then suddenly, as I pieced this thing together, and interestingly enough, it was on a very significant date that in time that I put all the pieces together, and I just had this eureka moment that I put it all together, and I get it. I understand it. Cha-ching, I got it. And that date was December 21st, 2012. That's the date that I put it all together. And if anybody doubts me, go look on my Facebook. There's a timeline of everything, and you'll see that's exactly where I discovered and put all these pieces together, exactly on that date. And it all just made sense, and that's when I realized I already knew this. I wasn't learning this. I was remembering this from my near-death experience, from a past life, from both, from something else. I couldn't quite tell you, but it was like remembering, not learning. And it all just clicked, and I understood it. So then the next step was to, you know, present it to the world.
And the name of the documentary is Secrets in Plain Sight. The filmmaker is Scott Onstott, Onstott. So, and that's when it just a, kind of like a light bulb went off, I guess, is if I'm clear on things
it,
here.
It and just, mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely. It just, it sparked, it triggered something in my brain that said, hey, he's on the right track. And I know the missing pieces, the missing components, and I know how they work together. And not only that, but I know when I put this together, it's going to tell me an amazing story. And sure enough, that's the case.
Okay. Just to let our listeners know, to remind people that are tuning in to today's show, that episode 42 of Pirate Radio Podcasts, that our guest here today is Robert Homrich, and we are discussing the esoteric Washington. Pretty much it's a Da Vinci Code type story and material that we're diving into here today. So we got a few questions coming in via YouTube. Tyranny Unmasked stating here that he knows exactly what he's talking about, already knowing a bit. So I guess this business of remembering what had up until that particular point been, I guess you'd been blocked off or cut off, shielded from seeing, so or being aware of. And Grayland is asking,
right,
what does the U.S. Post Office in D.C. mean? As Trump is president, does he have power to go any place with a postmaster general? I'm not too clear what he's exactly getting at there. Maybe you yourself would, Robert. Go ahead.
I don't really know how I could field that question. It's a tricky one. The post office was the first government office to be established in the United States. And it really is the most important and powerful agency when you consider that the world as we've known it for the, you know, past couple hundred years would have come grinding to a halt without it. So I know the postmaster has a lot of power, and it definitely delves into the legal side of things as well. But I don't know how I could actually field that question. I apologize, but I
all right. And Joe 333, thanks for coming on board and dropping by. Looks like he's a regular crew member, so it's good to see he. Making his appearance known. Well, let's see where we can next go with things here, steering the conversation along. You had mentioned earlier the business of, well, I'll tell you what, let's talk a little bit about this art prize, if that's okay, and then we can hit on a few other topics, of course, too. But that's actually how we're planning on closing off today's show. There was a cover tune from, I guess as it turns out, Tesla, their cover of the classic 60s protest song, Signs. So you've got that worked into a great little YouTube multimedia piece.
Yeah, thanks.
You've got there. We're going to close the show with that tune once again. Hopefully YouTube doesn't nickel and dime us too badly. They've been really...
they did me.
Oh, geez. Well, we've already, what has it managed to... what is it, like half a farthing or, a portion, small, just, an eighth of a shilling. This is what we've managed to acquire here so far, monetarily wise. So... I mean, they're really it's like we really deserve to be targeted with that. But anyways, your art prize.
If you're going to deliver the truth, you mm-hmm. know it's going to cost you.
Well, I tell you, this whole business of copyrights. You add one single song to your show, and then they just totally want to hand any potential profit that you make, like in monetizing things. You don't see a single cent. They want it all just to go to the musical artist. That's it. And you've done like a 90-minute show, maybe a 2-hour show, and all of it goes to these people that are, you know, got lately with these copyright claims. It seems a little pretty heavy-handed, obviously one-sided.
Land of the least. Thieves. Land of the fees, home of the slaves.
Oh, I think there's some options coming up, though, on the horizon, some changes.
I see it, too.
So, but let's hear a little bit about your art prizes, copyright issue, bit of a spat. I guess that you were, I'm not sure if you really got drawn into it too much on a personal basis. Sometimes when people want to engage us, it seems they're waiting for a reaction of sorts. And a lot of times myself, I know I just, I think the best strategy is really to ignore people a lot of times. But Danny Wilton, I think, people can find us all out there on YouTube. Yep. So what was his problem exactly? What was his issue?
Well, actually, I think it was more my issue. I was one that had the problem, and the problem was he was basically stealing my work. I came up with a design of my book cover, and it's basically it incorporates several geometric symbols into one harmonious image. It includes the flower of life, the Metatron's cube, Vitruvian man, Leonardo da Vinci's drawing. All these different symbols are incorporated in one, and I saw virtually the identical. It was a carbon copy ripoff of my work, and he's promoting it as his own work. And I took offense to it. I called him out for plagiarism, which is what it was. And of course, he denies it. Says, you know, it's all his own work and whatnot. But I mean, if you put the two images side by side, it's clear. And the thing is, I was friends with him on Facebook at the time. I mean, he knew about my work. He knew it existed. He liked it on several occasions. And so I felt he was plagiarizing my work. I called him out on it. He denied it. And so we had that dispute. And he wanted to turn it into a shouting match. And, you know, I'm going to make a video and just talk crap about you on YouTube. I just wasn't going to play that game. The evidence speaks for itself. Obviously, he felt defensive and had to, you know, go on the rebound and try and attack me. I wasn't going to play that game. I just called him out on his plagiarism and left it at that. I'm a bigger man than that. So I just let him make his videos and try and trash me or whatever. Go ahead, you know. The facts speak for themselves. It's all there. I don't need to explain myself on that, at least not to him.
Mm-hmm. You've been an artist recognized for your work for quite a few years now, too, producing art of all different sorts. From the sounds of it, why don't you just give us a little bit more of a few more details as far as what sort of recognition you've been receiving from people and just your background as an artist?
You know, I've been drawing all my life. Definitely the most noteworthy thing I did was the Vitruvian Code, and that definitely opened worlds for me. It opened so many different opportunities. The first one was Art Prize, like you mentioned. I entered that contest, and, they didn't like it. Interesting things about Art Prize, first of all, I don't even think I mentioned this during our pre-interview, but it was actually founded by a Freemason. So it's an art competition in my hometown, Grand Rapids, Michigan. You know, he started this competition. It's the world's largest art competition. They get about 2,000 entries per year or whatever. And it's publicly voted on. But obviously, if he's a Freemason, he has every reason why he doesn't want the public to view my artwork. I mean, if you've actually viewed the Vitruvian Code, know what I'm talking about, the image. It sent shockwaves throughout the community. It definitely resonated with people, and there was a lot of truth that, you know, it was undeniable in that image. And so they had every reason to not want the public to view it. And obviously, being the founder of Art Prize, you had a lot of control. And my work was covertly blacklisted from the competition. So basically, they left me right out of the competition, never told me, and never really informed the public of what was going on. I saw myself getting tons and tons and tons of votes. I had huge crowds, wanting explanations constantly for the three-week competition. Every day I had crowds in and out all day long asking questions, and I was, you know, delivering a presentation to, you know, 20, 30 people at a time all day long for 3 weeks. There's a lot of attention and buzz around this artwork, and then come to find out, I didn't even rank in the top 100 entries, and I could not believe that at all. So, not saying I should have won, but right, I should have definitely been in the top 100, and that kind of set off some alarm. And I started looking around the venue, and I can actually see, and I even presented evidence to show the measures they took to keep people from going into that venue to view my artwork. And I'm talking, for one, they left a sign out. They're supposed to leave a sign outside to inform visitors that there's art there. They didn't do that, first of all. Second of all, they transformed their lobby to make it look like the building was under construction and closed, just to keep people from walking in. And they put up obstacles to keep people from walking in. And so it was pretty obvious, and there were a lot of other signs as well. Any one you can kind of, you know, chalk up as, you know, coincidence, you know, just circumstances. But when you start adding up all these different things, and I had the evidence for right there, it starts to look an awful lot like they just created circumstances around that venue to keep people from coming in because they didn't want them to see it. But nonetheless, the word got around anyway, and people were coming in. I was drawing crowds despite all of that, and so they just did their magic. And obviously, there's no way to track the votes publicly, so they could. It's just like our presidential election; they can just really tell you any results they want to make up, you know, 6 months in advance, and it doesn't make any difference. People are none the wiser. And so I believe that's what happened to me. You know, I called them out. I publicly challenged them on it, and they refused to even acknowledge it. So the following year, I exposed them, Freemasonry connections and everything, right there, the whole hometown. We got a big building in Grand Rapids that's owned by the Freemason who founded Art Prize. And it, for crying out loud, it's got the Pythagorean triangle right on its roof. I mean, that's a telltale sign right there. They like to encode that kind of stuff in their architecture. Most of the Grand Rapids was not even, they were clueless to this fact until I pointed it out. I pointed out the connections. Everyone started saying, oh, you know what? You're starting to make a lot of sense. And it does look, so, you know, I had the public support was there for that. So the following year I protested it. I exposed them, and they haven't been the same since. Let's just put it that way. It really changed the whole atmosphere of that competition when I did the protest. And since then, the popularity has definitely decreased. So I definitely gave them a couple of good blows for that one.
You said earlier, I believe, that the Art Prize is the world's largest art competition, period?
That's what they claim.
Now they have presentations that are spread out then all over the world. They accept submissions via internet or
it's based out of Grand Rapids, mm-hmm. but it's held in multiple venues. So there's, especially downtown, there's a lot of different venues in downtown Grand Rapids that host artwork. And it spreads out into the rest of the city, but it's mostly concentrated downtown in all these different venues. And I'm talking, they transform the whole town. There's displays inside buildings, outside buildings. And so it's really, if pardon my French, it's really a clusterfuck, especially when you consider the voters are the public. For one, they can't even view all the artwork if they wanted to. And second, they wouldn't know where to find it. And it's all scattered everywhere. So there's no real way to take it all in and decide what one's best. First of all, I think that's one of the big flaws behind the competition. But there are many. But I think that's one of the biggest, is that it's just, it's not very well thought out. I think they've dropped the ball in so many ways with that competition, but
this is quite an amazing story that you're presenting here today on so many levels.
We haven't even really got to the good stuff yet.
Oh, I know. We have about 40 minutes and plus the after show, which we've talked about. Hopefully you'll be joining us there. You're still good to go with the Rogues Gallery end of things. I know you're on the road and, you know, kind of working with the signal there. It's in and out and so forth. So, but people on YouTube seem to think things are coming across okay. So maybe not as bad as we think. So you basically outed him as a Freemason just coincidentally, I guess, as it turned out. So you did not know at the time of the competition that was the case.
I actually didn't, but I did have my suspicions. One of my first suspicions came when a bank sponsored me. A bank offered to host my artwork, and I thought that was interesting, just considering the Freemasonry connection to modern banking. And no, so that one definitely kind of put me on alert. So I did have suspicions from the get-go, But I did not confirm for myself that the founder, Rick DeVos, was in fact a Mason until, you know, I started looking deeper. But I mean, and then it really hit me and occurred to me when I just looked up at the building right there downtown, and it's the Pythagorean Triangle. I mean, that's like, you know, it couldn't be more obvious than that. When you know what to look for.
Yeah. Well, for those with eyes to see, and as you said earlier, sure. most people just anywhere, not as Grand Rapids, but right across the globe, have no idea. Very, very small percentage.
Everywhere.
Exactly. Well, but unless people have you know, been educated in these areas, or maybe read a few books, or watched the occasional documentary on these subjects, they're completely clueless and are being unconsciously programmed the entirety, pretty much of their whole lives. You know, so.
Sure, and not just in that aspect, in literally every aspect that you can imagine. I mean, down to the history you learn and the vocabulary we use. People don't really understand. I don't think they really realize how susceptible they are to that kind of programming.
Absolutely. I mean, it works on so many different levels. So now it was interesting. I didn't know up until the point of just hearing one of your earlier interviews that Vitruvian was actually a Roman architect. Is that correct? Or
Vitruvius.
Vitruvius. Why don't we start there? We can just back things up there and then kind of work our way up into the landscape of modern day Washington, D.C. and how that all kind of flows together.
Right. Vitruvius was a first century architect, a Roman architect. And he's often referred to as the grandfather of architecture not because he was really the first architect, but he is the first architect with the oldest known surviving works on architecture. Basically, he wrote the 10 books on architecture known as De Architectura. And one of his most famous assertions was his belief that in order for a building to be beautiful, it had to carry perfect whole racial proportions like those found in nature and those found in the human body. So basically what he's saying is for your building to be truly beautiful, you have to proportion it like the human body. And he's the guy that posed a riddle that it took about 1,500 years for it to be solved. He's the guy that posed the riddle that the idea that the human anatomy could be defined by squaring the circle. Okay, so many artists came along and tried to solve his riddle, and they created, anatomical drawings based on squaring the circle, but none of them ever really worked. The geometry was wrong, and they couldn't figure it out. Leonardo da Vinci is the one who came along and figured out the riddle, to solve the riddle, everyone was thinking inside the box. Everyone was thinking that the square had to be centered with the circle, and Vitruvius never said, and now Da Vinci comes along, and of course we all know he thinks outside the box, and where do you think that phrase comes from, thinking outside the box? He's the one who finally realized that the square, or the box, didn't have to be centered with that circle, and he could shift it down, and when he did that, he made the anatomy work perfectly with the geometry. They harmonized, so that's what the Vitruvian Man is, the famous drawing. We all know the drawing. You might not know the name, but I know you know the drawing. It's the drawing of the guy with his arms stretched out. He's got four arms and four legs, and he's in a square and a circle. Everybody knows the drawing. That's it, and that's the origins of it. And then, of course, who created that drawing? Leonardo da Vinci. Well, back to Dan Brown, what was his first book? It was the Da Vinci Code. So now we're starting to touch upon some of the real secrets of the Vitruvian Code. So that's basically the story of Vitruvius and how he really ties into it all.
We've got the Vitruvian Man. Yeah, we've added the picture, the classic photo of him to the slideshow that we have streaming on YouTube at the moment. So Joe Eminon has now joined us, too. It's great to see. It looks like a handful of people, about seven is what YouTube tells us, watching and just following things along here as we... as we put this show and the interview together. So all competitions are rigged, is what Joe Eminon claims, kind of along the lines of what Trump was saying during the course of the election. And,
yeah.
You know, he's right. I mean, I saw that growing up as a kid, a lot of like the hockey, a lot of the hockey games, and they choose, what is it, the 3-star selection at the end of the game, and the people that, the kids that get the trophies, you know, the hockey tournaments.
I often take a lot of flack for being a wrestling fan. Now, you want to talk rigged? Mm-hmm. It doesn't come any more rigged than wrestling. Those years,
yeah,
really taught me the secrets of seeing through the illusions of everything. And it's funny, you know, you talk about Trump, and he's talking about the elections being rigged. He's telling you more than you realize. What he's telling you is it's been rigged all along. Since the beginning, it was planned that he was going to win this. They just set him up to be the opposition so that the people would accept him. And that's why he was vilified by everybody, including the Pope. They did that to put him in a position where the people would believe he's on their side. But he himself told you it's all rigged. And if you look anywhere, you're going to find that same illusion. You're going to find it in pro wrestling. They did it with Stone Cold Steve Austin. Vince McMahon vilified him to get him in the position of a fan favorite. That you watch wrestling, that's where I learned how to spot a lot of these illusions. You see the same stuff in politics. Where does politics take place? It takes place in arena. Where does the wrestling take place? It takes place in arena. It's the same mechanics in politics and pro wrestling. It's the exact same thing. There's a shadow government, yeah, for sure. And then there's the real the puppet government.
Yeah, it's long been said, you know, that politics is just, it's essentially, as you say, professional wrestling in expensive 3-piece business suits, you know. So sure. And the two the red states and the blue states, that's kind of Freemasonic, I would imagine. Sure.
Well, if you look at wrestling, you got Raw and SmackDown, the red brand and the blue brand.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And where else do we know Trump from? Oh, yeah, we saw him at WrestleMania, didn't we?
Right, yeah. So that's interesting. So basically, I guess your position is that he's not as much of an outside insider. I guess that's the best way. Yeah,
well, let me ask you this. He's a builder. He's a builder. How can he not be a Freemason? He's a billionaire builder in New York City. How can you build a single building in that town without being a Mason? How can you get to where he is without being established?
Well, he's got a few.
That's why he's vilified so much, to get people to realize, or believe, I'm sorry, not realize, but to believe that he was an outsider, because it's so obvious he was.
A couple golf courses in Scotland too, let's not forget. So sure. The golf connection, and, you know, Two Ball Cane and what have you. So, you know, sure. Look into that whole business with golf and whatnot. A very Masonic game, supposedly. So, but let's continue if you don't mind. We can maybe once again just kind of shift gears and bring things a little more up to speed and up to date. So, who basically laid the ground? You know, put the ground plans together and the blueprints for the architectural design for Washington D.C.
Well, it was really It was really a whole committee that did that. Of course, it was headed by George Washington himself. He actually chose the site, the location. It was actually on his own land. So he actually chose the land. The astrological alignments were done, before we get to that, the foundation stones, not the foundation stones, but the marker stones were laid out by a city planner known as Andrew Ellicott. And it was his assistant, Benjamin Banneker, a freeborn African-American, who did the astrology and helped him lay it out to the astrology. Thomas Jefferson was a consultant advisor to the whole committee. And then, of course, the plans themselves were created by a French architect named Pierre Charles L'Enfant, who had served with Washington in the Revolutionary War.
Players. African American astrologer? Did I hear that right?
Yes, he was a very educated man, self-taught. He published an almanac, in fact, on astrology. So that he was a very uncommon man for the time. He was definitely very educated. He was born a free man. He worked with Ellicott, who actually, one of the things I should note on there is, L'Enfant was kind of, he was very well known for his temperament. He was very temperamental. And a lot of times when they're developing these plans, the other members of the committee would recommend small changes to the plans. And he was so animate about not changing the plans. It had to be to the point where heated arguments developed, and over the course of the planning, he actually was fired from the job of being architect for basically a number of heated conflicts that happened with Ellicott, Jefferson. He and Jefferson were at ends through the whole planning phase. And the straw that broke the camel's back was when Andrew Ellicott went to get the plans for the engraving, and L'Enfant refused to provide them. And so the legend says that Ellicott, with the help of his brother, who's also named Benjamin, and for that reason he's confused with Banneker, but it was a different guy. It was actually his brother who helped him, as the legend goes, and I want to stress this is the legend, he helped Ellicott finish out L'Enfant's plans because apparently he had like a photographic memory or something. Now that's the legend, but I would speculate and I would hint more towards the fact that they simply stole L'Enfant's plans. But again, I just want to stress that I'm only speculating that, but the legend is that Ellicott didn't finish all the plans.
So L'Enfant, I believe is how you pronounce his name. He was overly precocious, as I think is what you're telling us here, found to be difficult to work with. But he was fired. You said Jefferson let him go, had him removed from his position. But then was he asked to return and finish?
No, he wasn't. He was dismissed from the project, and Ellicott picked up the slack that he left behind.
Okay, and this, just to be clear, how true to L'Enfant's vision his predecessor, or do I have that backwards?
I see where you're going with it. Yeah. Ellicott, he followed his plan. There were very few changes to his plan.
To L'Enfant's
plan.
Let
alone are there much changes to the plan. Right, and even today, Washington, D.C. stands very close to L'Enfant's original vision of the city. He did make a few changes. One of the big controversies of that whole thing that led to his dismissal was somebody's house was destroyed because it was standing in the way of his plans. So he just kind of up and destroyed someone's house, and there was a big controversy that arose from that as well. So, it's definitely the city, the plan. Planning of the city was just as every bit as controversial as the design is today. Just the planning stages of it were every bit as controversial. So,
all right, Pirate Larry, we have not heard from him in the last little while, so maybe now might be the time to see if he's picked up a thing or two over the course of the discussion that we've had here over the past number of minutes, and any interesting points that you're hoping to hit on, Larry?
Well, we're in Washington, D.C., and we have the Vitruvian Man, and so I'd like to know a little bit about some of the sites that, create the boundaries, the meanings of those. Apparently there are chakras involved and other geometric symbols, and so, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, let me walk you guys through how that all works. First of all, we got to start, and this one I find pretty interesting myself. The first clue, see, they left all the clues in the layout to solve the code, and the first clue you need to take note of is sitting right outside of the Capitol building with Pennsylvania and Maryland Avenues. And if you look at a satellite photo, you're going to see what they're really, what L'Enfant was really depicting there was the Masonic Compass. That's Pennsylvania and Maryland Avenue. If you look at it from above, just outside, emanating from the Capitol building, it's a compass. I mean, it's got the head of the compass on it and everything. And, of course, we know that to be a Masonic symbol. What's interesting about Freemasonry, and you always have the esoteric explanations and the exoteric explanation.
Right.
The exoteric explanation is the explanation that's intended for the masses, while the esoteric is intended for those with the eyes to see. Now, you ask a Freemason what the square and compass really symbolizes in Freemasonry, and most likely the go-to answer they give you is that the square reminds them to keep their actions square with their fellow man, and the compass reminds them to circumscribe their lives with the principles of Freemasonry, or so something to that effect. But when you really get deeper into the meaning of the square and the compass, what do they really symbolize? The answer is right there in Leonardo's drawing. It's squaring the circle. obviously you use the square to make the square and use the compass to make the circle. The real reason they choose that emblem is because it represents squaring the circle, which is synonymous with doing the impossible. So again, touching on Leonardo da Vinci, you've got squaring the circle is the driving force of the Vitruvian Man. I mean, that's what it's all about, squaring the circle. So these things are connected. There's more going on here than you realize. That square, that actual compass in the layout of Washington, D.C. is actually the key to solving the entire riddle. And you actually can use that same compass made up of Pennsylvania and Maryland Avenues to scale the Vitruvian Man in perfect harmonious proportion with the rest of the city. And you do that simply by measuring the encompass length of 12th Street and using that measurement to scale one quarter or cubit of the Vitruvian Man's height. So that compass spread on 12th Street is equal to one quarter of the Vitruvian Man's height. Once you have him in scale, you just place him on the map by taking the line above his head and dissecting Logan and DuPont circles, which make up the pentagram in Washington, D.C. They make up the very top horns of the pentagram, or Baphomet, if you will.
So cubits, I think most people, I know, speaking for myself at least, familiar with that terminology because of its reference and context of the Noah's Ark. Is that not
sure.
correct? So just to be clear,
it's a unit of measurement. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's basically based on the length of the tip of the finger to the elbow, which is approximately 17 or 18 inches. And of course, there are variations depending on the source of who's, you know, where you get your cubit from. There are different variations, but it's usually between 17 and 18 inches. That's technically a cubit is 18 inches. I think by today's standards, we view it as 18. But you'll find different variations. And, of course, it all goes back to the biblical texts and describes more than just Noah's Ark. I mean, they use it to describe the Ark of the Covenant, a lot of other things as well. But, again, it's just a unit of measurement like we use the foot today.
What of the golden ratio, and how in particular does that tie into things?
Oh, well, that's, again, that's human proportions. The Vitruvian Man himself, it's all based on the golden ratio. That gold, those divine proportions, if you will, you know, like Vitruvius was touching upon when he said in order for a building to be beautiful, it had to carry the proportions of the human body. Basically what he was saying there, in order for a building to be beautiful, it had to possess the golden ratio. So it's just a very aesthetically pleasing proportion for the human eye. For some reason, we just, it resonates with us.
Aren't you also saying... I think you might, I'm not sure, I haven't had a chance to read your book yet, but that, and I'm guessing that you go into this in some deal, some detail at some point, that this, in some ways, the layout of Washington, D.C. in particular, the landscaping and the architectural design, engineering, mapping of the city, that it actually, the Vitruvian Man is actually an imitation or replica of Christ on the cross.
Right. Well, we haven't gotten that far yet. First, I want to touch on the chakras.
Okay. Let's do that then, and then follow through with that.
Right. So once you get the Vitruvian Man in his proper scale on the map, you're going to find an astonishing number of alignments. Let's start with the angled streets. Literally every single angled street in Washington, D.C., you're going to find points directly to the key locations of the Vitruvian Man's anatomy. You'll notice that I think it's New York and Pennsylvania Avenue are perfect alignment, or the perfect angles of his arms. You'll notice that the squares, or the circles and square that make up the pentagram in Washington, D.C., are in perfect alignment with the dividing lines in the Vitruvian Man's shoulders and elbows. But basically what you're looking at there is the Vitruvian Man has his own chakra, like Larry said. You start with the root chakra, that would be represented by the Jefferson Memorial. Then above that, you have the reproductive chakra, which, of course, is represented by the giant penis in Washington, D.C., the Washington Monument. So it's no coincidence that that's the sexual chakra. It's the Washington Monument, which, coincidentally, is perfectly it's in just about the right space as Vitruvian Man's, you know, family jewels. So it's a little bit off, but there's a reason for that, and that's simply because they actually wanted to position the monument where it would be directly on the jewels, but the problem was back when they were trying to build it, D.C. was a swamp, and the land was too marshy to support the weight of the Washington Monument. They actually had to shift it over. So that's why you're going to notice it's slightly off-center from the rest of the chakra system. But it's a historical fact. You can just look it up that they had to reposition it because of the marshlands.
According to people such as Trump, it pretty much still is a swamp.
Sure,
Trump
absolutely.
And his followers. So I guess
right.
So when he says let's drain the swamp, there's
right.
that kind of works on several levels then, apparently.
Yeah, absolutely. It really was swampland. It was marshland. So yeah. So above the Washington Monument, we have the navel chakra, which is represented by the Washington ellipse. And you look at Vitruvian Man, it almost takes on the form of his stomach, or perhaps even a womb if you were a woman, which we'll kind of get into that in a little bit too. Above that, the White House represents the heart chakra. Above that, you would have K Street representing the throat chakra, but there's actually no chakra there because the throat chakra is associated with the throat and communication. So the secret behind keeping the secrets is you just don't charge the Vitruvian Man's throat chakra. That's part of the keys to their secrecy. Then above that, you have Ajna, the third eye chakra, which is represented by Scott Circle, which actually takes on the form of the Star of David. And also, there's a lot of sacred geometry that lays out over this as well. And if you lay the Kabbalistic Tree of Life on Washington, D.C., you'll find that Scott Circle also represents Dath, or Dath, which is basically on the Kabbalistic Tree of Life, which basically it represents knowledge. It literally means knowledge. So not only is that the third eye chakra, but it's representing Dath, or knowledge, on the Kabbalistic Tree of Life. And then, of course, at the top, we have the crown chakra, which is represented by none other than the national headquarters of Scottish Rite Freemasonry Southern Jurisdiction. That's the House of the Temple. And it's interesting that it's called a temple, and you know that really ties into the anatomy and where the Ark of the Covenant is really stored. It's stored in the temples, but we can kind of get in that. I'm going to give a couple clues, but we'll get into that a little bit later. But that's there's a chakra system. One other thing we should probably touch upon too is the Washington Monument. We've all heard the jokes that it represents a giant penis, but when you lay it out with the Vitruvian Man, it's no longer a joke. It really does represent a giant penis. But what's really interesting is when you take that into account with the pathways that surround the Washington Monument, because if you look at a satellite image, you're going to find a pattern which is known in geometry as a vesica piscis, and basically it's just two overlapping circles, and this creates kind of not really an eight, but kind of like a figure eight, but they're just overlapped.
What is
that's
and
known
the
as
Pisces,
a piscis,
right? The Pisces, I'm guessing, based on my limited knowledge, though, that's going to take us right to the genital area with the fish sign, correct?
Sure. It is, and that's what it literally represents, the Vesica Pisces. You can look it up yourself, look on Wikipedia, and there's a number of other sources. If you go to Wikipedia, they'll cite sources, numerous sources, who are going to tell you that the Vesica Pisces is symbolic of a woman's vagina.
Vesica in English means...
Not only...
Rob, what does Vesica mean in English exactly?
Well, the name, the word, I believe, translates to the bladder of a fish because of its shape. It's kind of shaped like a fish. And that's where we get the Jesus fish as well. That's what the Jesus fish is really representing. It's the womb of Mary.
Are you also, or maybe you're not aware, I'm guessing you're probably not. I might be off on this one. But that was one of the first icons and symbols used in ancient Buddhism. As well, actually,
well,
it preceded
Christianity.
It actually preceded Christianity. Their use of the fish,
sure,
in the religious iconography. Yeah,
and so did most of the other traditions of Christianity. A lot of it is borrowed from paganism. You wanted to talk about the Christmas trees, and we could go into Christmas trees and the symbolism of that, and it's in the origins of Christmas and paganism. All of Christianity is almost completely derived of older traditions, and you know, you talk about the Christmas tree and what it really represents. The reason we illuminate our Christmas trees is because it's representing an illuminated tree of life, Kabbalistic tree of life. It's an illuminated chakra system, but it's also a representation of the burning bush, which itself is a representation of the tree of life or an illuminated chakra system. So, again, this is all stuff that's been, you know, handed down, and it's like a big game of telephone where you whisper it in someone's ear, and then they whisper it in the next person's ear, and by the end of the chain, you have a completely different phrase than you started out with. That's kind of how we have our modern religions, because it's all really derived from the ancient true religion that everything's based on. It's all derived from that, but it's been so horribly mistranslated and misrepresented throughout the ages that most of the teachers don't even know what this stuff really means anymore.
Right.
I don't mean to get off track.
Oh, well, that's fine. No, I mean, hey, there's so much material here that we could cover, and I think you've especially done a great job in the time frame that we've been working with here. We've got about 10 minutes left. We sometimes carry things through a little further, although generally we like to transition on to the back end of the show, which is the Rogues Gallery segment of things. So, but what would you like to say then, just in the closing few minutes here? We got, like I said, 10 minutes, maybe 15.
We were just talking about Christianity, mm-hmm. and Christ, and you were talking about the connection to Christ. Why don't we close it out with that? I think I can wrap it up in that much time, and we'll leave it at that and take it into the next part. But basically, you were mentioning how the Vitruvian Man is a representation of Christ, and I'll tell you where I come to that conclusion. It's really interesting because, first of all, squaring the circle and one of the things that makes Vitruvian Man so remarkable is that it's probably the best artist rendition of perfect anatomy. I mean, the geometry is perfect. It's perfectly proportioned, and it's noteworthy for that. Well, there's another example of squaring the circle that is also world-renowned for its perfect proportions, and that is the Great Pyramid of Giza. And basically, the proportions of that are derived from squaring the circle just the same, and it's world-renowned for perfect proportion. Well, what's interesting is that also ties into the Vitruvian Code in Washington, D.C. When you proportion the same size square, the same size circle, and you with the pyramid as from the Vitruvian Man, and you incorporate that in the design of Washington, D.C., and lay it out the way I have it, if you go to my website, the Vitruvian Code Facebook page, you'll find some examples. But when you lay out the pyramid in its proper proportion and scale over the Vitruvian Man, you're going to find some even more interesting alignments. For starters, the pyramid points to every wound suffered by Christ on the Vitruvian Man. You've got the missing capstone representing the crown of thorns. You've got the four vent shafts of the pyramid pointing to the four nail wounds on Vitruvian Man, on his arms. And those are represented by four stars in the sky. They are Sirius, Alnitak, which is in Orion's belt, Kochab, and Thuban. So the final wound, of course, the spear wound, is represented by the roof of the King's Chamber. And if you put it on Washington, D.C., you'll find that that's in perfect alignment with the Theodore Roosevelt Memorial Bridge in Washington, D.C. So literally, the pyramid's pointing at every wound suffered by Christ. And now you want to get back to the Da Vinci Code. And, of course, Da Vinci created the Vitruvian Man. Get back to the Da Vinci Code and his story of the bloodline of Christ. The most interesting thing of all is that this places the Queen's Chamber directly over the phallus of the Vitruvian Man. Or, no pun intended, to put it another way, he's literally entering the Queen's Chamber, if you catch my drift. Okay, that's a symbol of sexual union, and it's right over top of the Vesica Pisces with the Washington Monument resting it. So not only is our nation's capital, you know, built around this gigantic penis, but that gigantic penis is resting in the Washington inside a vagina. And then furthermore, you look at the Vitruvian Man, and his penis is resting right in the Queen's Chamber, which is, again, a symbol. So that symbolism repeats itself over and over just in the diagram itself. And in fact, the part I find most interesting about the Vitruvian Code itself is this. Every time you add a new layer, and there are many layers, several layers we haven't even touched upon, but every time you do, not only does the image echo repeatedly a particular symbolism or a particular message, but the image itself takes on that appearance. And when you put the Vitruvian Man and the pyramid out like I did, it not only echoes the theme of the bloodline of Christ and this sexual union, but in fact, it even takes on the appearance of Jesus on and ascending from the cross. And that's what I find so interesting, is not only is it giving you this message, but the visual is right there and it coincides. And it works that way. Each time you add a new layer to this puzzle, you get a visual image that echoes the message of the symbolism that you're reading. So it's really, that's what blows my mind the most about it, is just simply that here you are, you're looking, it's pointing to the wounds of Christ, you're talking about sexual use, and then to top it all off, it looks like Christ on and ascending from the cross, which I find that astonishing myself.
Now, you were not the first person to uncover or realize these things, I don't think, but there is some credit to, if you were to give credit to anyone, who would that be? Well, but also, I'm sure there are things that you have discovered on your own that no one else maybe had picked up on to this point. Is that right?
As far as laying the Vitruvian Man on DC, that's all me. As far as laying the pyramid, there are other people who have different theories. There's a Rick Campbell who runs DC Symbols. He's kind of sees an image, it's somewhat abstract image of the cross section of the pyramid, and but it's different and it's not laid out quite the way I did. But as far as laying the Vitruvian Man and all this stuff out, that's all stuff that originated for me. You're not going to find that stuff anywhere else. Now, I certainly did, with my research and publishing my book, I definitely borrowed a lot of previous research from other people, such as Rick Campbell and DC Symbols. And probably the most noteworthy one that I did would be David Ovison, who wrote The Secret Architecture of Our Nation's Capital, The Masons and the Building of Washington, D.C., which is a very well-known book. He was kind of the guy who really... he blazed the trail that I kind of followed, and I took it a whole different level. I mean, several levels beyond what he did. But he's the guy who really blazed the trail and started this whole investigation. So I definitely took a lot of his research and incorporated it into my stuff, as well as a few others.
Rob, we missed the name of the author there. You're breaking up a little too much. Could you just repeat his name, please?
Sure. That's David Ovison, O-V-A-S-O-N, I believe. David Ovison. He wrote The Secret Architecture of Our Nation's Capital, subtitled The Masons and the Building of Washington, D.C.
All right. Now, people might want to check that out, and just to further beef up on their research, you yourself, of course, have your own book. I guess we could plug that now as we're winding things down. What is the title, and where can people find it?
Sure. My book is called The Vitruvian Code, The Secret Secret Anatomy of Washington, D.C., and its Connections to the Ancient Mysteries. And you should be able to find that on CreateSpace or Yahoo, or not Yahoo, I'm sorry, Amazon.
People can make their purchase via PayPal, I'd imagine. Any other means of
whatever's the norm for Amazon, or, you know.
Okay, yeah.
I think it would PayPal or whatever. I'm not really sure. One other thing I'd like to plug as well, real quick, is obviously this spring I got to plug this. I'll be starting my own tour company in Washington, D.C. So if you really want to learn about this stuff and you happen to be in D.C., hit me up. And my plan is to take people on a real-life mystery tour where you're going to actually learn these secrets right there in person. We're going to put together this treasure map, piece by piece, by solving different puzzles and learning the real history and esoteric symbolism of Washington, D.C. at the same time. So it's going to be a very unique interactive tour in which requires the tourists or the visitors' participation.
Absolutely. Sounds like a lot of fun. So,
Yeah, you'll be able to find that here in the next couple of days. We're working on building the website right now. Hopefully in the next couple of days we'll have it up and running, but you'll be able to find that at dcinteractivemysteries.com.
dcinteractivemysteries.com. Excellent.
I'm sorry. That's dcinteractivemysterytours.com.
dcinteractivemysterytours.com. Great. While we're on the subject, that reminds me, we were talking in the pre-interview just yesterday about minds.com. You've yet to actually put a channel together over there, but you are, I guess, giving it some consideration. I know that what you have to offer here, the information and knowledge, insight that you're sharing with the world would be probably quite favorably received. So, Any further thoughts, or where do things stand on that front?
It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. I just got a lot on my table. I will definitely get around to creating a profile and getting something up and running there. It's just a matter of when, you know, like, as soon as I get the free time and the ambition to do it, you know, it won't be long, I assure you that. I've heard a lot of good things about it.
Excellent. You know, one of the topics here, I think you've yourself, based on what I could gather through Facebook, you have a personal interest in Gnosticism, and that's a whole other can of worms, of course, too. Is that
most of what you're going to find on my Facebook is almost directly tied to my work. The one thing you're going to find, there's maybe one or two subjects that aren't going to be related that you're going to find a lot of posts from me about. But literally all of it otherwise is tied right into my work, even the Gnosticism. I don't practice any particular religion myself. I certainly believe in a higher creator, but I don't feel the need to quantify them any further than that. I certainly don't have the brain capacity to define what God is or what his purpose is or intent. I don't even try. So I don't really subscribe to any particular religions, but yet I see truth in all of them. But I also see a lot of deception and a lot of misconception in all of it as well. So I'm very... My big thing is the dogma. There's too much dogma attached to the religions. So, you know, that's one of the things you'll learn from my page is I try to teach you the truth behind these religions, true stuff, like where the Christmas tree come from and what it really represents. That's the kind of stuff I want to teach you, but I don't want to put dogma on it, and I don't want to put just a... I feel like if I were to take a Christian approach, I'd be alienating the rest of the community. If I took a Jewish approach, whatever... I feel like I'd be I'm speaking to the world and everybody. I'm not here to judge anybody. I'm not here to, you know, I'm not here to play my God is better than your God. I'm just here to get to the truth and, you know, try and get other, I have important messages to deliver to people. And so that's what I do.
Mm-hmm. It kind of actually reminds you of the way that some performers and artists are. Steve Martin is the classic example, how for years, unlike, for example, Bruce Springsteen, who, great as his music is, the problem with coming out as a partisan supporter of any, you know, one political party over the other, that especially the main two, you know, parties in the U.S., that you end up, as you say, alienating half of your audience, you know, or at least you run that risk, the risk of doing sure. So. So, yeah, but whereas Steve Martin has just for years just kept his politics to himself, really, and, you know, just left it at that and remained, of course, a great artist and entertainer.
Well, see, that's one thing I'm not so good at is keeping my opinions and my politics to myself. That's one thing I definitely don't do. Certainly, I'm not going to judge anybody if they want to support Trump or mm-hmm. Hillary. I say they're all criminals, and I don't support any of them. I'm perfectly comfortable leading myself and taking that approach. But if somebody else wants to take the approach of supporting Trump or Hillary, or for whatever reasons, I can't imagine why, and it's not my place to. That's fine, you know. I'm not going to hold anybody's beliefs against them. Personally, I have less room for beliefs and more room for fact. So that's the approach I like to take.
A lot of issues that we didn't manage to get into or to have a chance to address here today that we're going to be saving for the Rogues Gallery end of things. One of the, just quickly though, the themes or topics that we could just touch on as we draw things to a close here is this business of the apocalypse. And, end of show topic, but go ahead. Let me just, sure, it'd be interesting to hear what you say, and then maybe I can respond in turn, or maybe we'll have some commentary from the YouTube listeners.
Sure. Let me just put it this way. The apocalypse is all in your head. And I mean that it's probably not what you're thinking. They left a clue in D.C., by the way, on this. If you look at the Capitol building, guess what? You can lay out the Vitruvian Man right over that, and it works just as well. That dome on top of the Capitol building, that's symbolic of a skull. Now, when you go inside that building and you look up at the ceiling of that dome, you're going to find a fresco painted by, Constantine Brumidi, I believe was his name. It's called The Apotheosis of Washington, and it visually depicts George Washington ascending into the heavens as a god. And the word itself, apotheosis, means just that, the deification of a person, or, you know, their ascent into godhood. And you see that right there inside the Capitol building under what's a symbolic of the human skull. That's what they're saying. The apocalypse literally means an unveiling of great knowledge. Now, they went and transformed that. They changed the meaning to mean the end of the world and conjure up these images of disaster and destruction. But what it really means is an unveiling, a great revelation. In fact, that's why the book is called the Book of Revelations. It's not the end of the world. It's revealing stuff. Mm-hmm. Now, see, the thing is, the apocalypse is subject to the individual, and it's going to happen when the individual is ready. It's not going to happen for all of us at once, but at some point, you're going to have a great revelation, whether you're alive at that point or not, or maybe it's even in another lifetime. What they're telling you with this painting being underneath the head, that's saying that your ascent to godhood must occur inside, underneath the dome. That's where the apocalypse occurs. It's also where the Ark of the Covenant is stored, but we can get into that in the rogue section. So they have intentionally twisted the meaning of the word apocalypse to make you fear. Same thing they do with the word occult. Occult doesn't mean, it's with anarchy as well. You know, occult, people generally, when you say the word occult, people think Satanism. And what occult really means is hidden from view. I mean, it's from the word ocular, which, binoculars, it has to do with the sight, hidden from sight. That's what occult really means. Anarchy, everyone thinks it means chaos, but it really means just without a ruler. But they change the meaning of our words simply to make us fear certain words and to make us stray from these things, like occult, like apocalypse, like anarchy. These are dirty words to them. They don't want you to, in their true context. So they change the context. Now, if you want to be a Bible thumper, you look up the story of the Tower of Babel. What are they telling you there? They're telling you that the angels fell to the earth and corrupted the language. Well, there you go. And if you want to find where the language is corrupted the most, you need to look no further than the American legal system. That's where you're going to find the most corruption of the English language, but it's everywhere. And that's what they're really telling you with the whole story of the Tower of Babel. In fact, that's why we speak Babel. We're speaking nonsense. It doesn't make sense.
Maybe we'll have a chance, hopefully, to get more into that, the straw man legal fiction.
Sure.
In the Rogues Gallery.
You know why it's called a straw man, right? The reason it's called a straw man,
it's a weak opponent. False opponent.
Right. Well, what is a voodoo doll made out of? Voodoo dolls are made out of straw. And it's with your straw man voodoo doll that a magistrate, which means the word, it's a derivative of two words, a magical strategist, can sit in his long black robes and, quote, summons your spirit to appear before him. Tell me they're not using magic.
Worshipful masters. And tell me that's not...
Masonic gavels.
That has nothing to do with religion. So, think again, people. But, once again, totally on board with your unpacking of the term apocalypse. That was, actually pretty much, thinking along the same lines there for sure, with it being a revelation kind of, lifting of the veil.
Anybody can look up the etymology and see for themselves, if there's any doubters. It's not hard to look at the etymology, and it's right there.
Mm-hmm. So absolutely, and definitely been overly politicized. I think archaeology has been one of the great contributors, really. One of the things that, as just an institution, has helped to basically bring about, this apocalypse, this lifting of the veil. And
sure. Why do you suppose it is? They often come into, anytime they come up with a theory that, challenges the status quo, why do you suppose that these archaeologists are so ostracized? I mean, they don't want us digging up our past, because if we dug up our past, we're going to see how badly they fucked us all. So,
That's right. No, absolutely. Couldn't agree more. So we're talking...
It couldn't be more obvious.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
All right. Well, we've got, I mean, there's so many good things that we have to discuss here, and looking forward to, animated and colorful conversation as we kick off our boots and undo the belt buckles, maybe set the cutlasses and muskets aside. So thank you very much, Robert. I think we've basically covered as much as we're going to be able to do here today, and hopefully have not missed out on anything that we should have addressed. Basically,
well, there's always next time too.
There you go. And that's the thing, is we like to always leave the door open to have guests back and to explore new material and areas of discussion and thought. So thank you once again. We'll see you in the back end of things here in the Rogues Gallery in just a minute or two.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, man. I appreciate it.
Okay. All the best and ahoy. Pirate Larry, just a quick overview or breakdown of things that were discussed today. Any outstanding thoughts or commentary that you're hoping to add to things?
I'm getting out of this breezy wind up here in the crow's nest, and I'm making it over to the Mossy Winch where I can have a nice warm ale. And you're all invited.
Yeah, the Mossy Winch. I think we've got, there should be a few fair lady over that particular location that we'll be able to, we'll be happy to service a brew or two. So, looking forward to it, Pyro Larry.
Great show. It was, I learned a lot, and I'm real interested in the after show to dig deeper and get into this some more. So thank you, Robert.
Thank you.
We'll see you guys over there in just a few moments. Good night.
Sounds good.
Step right up.
And the sign says a long-haired freaky people need not apply. So I took my hair up under my hat and I went in to ask him why. He said, "You look like a fine, outstanding young man. I think you do." So I took off my hat. I said, "Imagine that, oh, me, was it for you?" Oh, signs everywhere, the sign blocking out the scenery, breaking my mind. Don't do that, can't you read the sign? And the sign says anybody caught trespassing will be shot on sight. So I jumped the fence and yelled to the house, "Hey, what gives you the right to put up a fence and keep me out, or to keep Mother Nature in? Tell it to your face, man, some kind of sinner." Signs everywhere, a sign blocking out the scenery, breaking my mind. Do this, don't do that, can't you read the sign? Oh, I say now, mister, can't you read? You've got to have a certain tiny to see. You can't watch, no, you can't eat. You ain't supposed to. And the sign says you got to have a membership card to get inside. I said, "Ugh." And the sign says everybody welcome, come in and kneel down and pray. but then they passed around a plate at the end of it out, and I didn't have a penny to pay, so I got me a pen and a paper.